32. Lenin. The young Russian midshipman carried himself proudly. His battle armor was spotless, and all his equipment arranged properly by the book. "The Admiral requests that you come to the bridge," he chirped in flawless Anglic. Rod Blaine followed listlessly. They floated through the airlock from Lenin's number 2 hangar deck to a flurry of salutes from Kutyasov's Marines. The full honors of a visiting captain only stirred his grief. He'd given his last orders, and he'd been the last man to leave his ship. Now he was an observer, and this was probably the last time anyone would render him boarding honors. Everything aboard the battleship seemed too large, yet he knew it was only an illusion. With few exceptions, the compartments and corridors of capital ships were standardized, and he might as well have been aboard MacArthur. Lenin was at battle stations, with all her airtight doors closed and dogged. Marines were posted at the more important passageway controls, but otherwise they saw no one, and Rod was glad of that. He could not have faced any of his former crew or passengers. Lenin's bridge was enormous. She was fitted out as a flagship, and in addition to the screens and command posts for the ship herself, there were a dozen couches for the Admiral's battle staff. Rod woodenly acknowledged the Admiral's greeting and sank gratefully into the flag captain's chair. He didn't even wonder where Commander Borman, Kutyasov's flag lieutenant and chief of staff, had gone. He was alone with the Admiral at the flag command station. MacArthur was displayed from half a dozen views on the screens above him. The last of Lenin's boats were pulling away from her. Staley must have accomplished his mission, Rod thought. Now she has only a few minutes to live. When she's gone, I'll really be finished. A newly promoted captain who lost his ship on her first mission. Even the Marquis' influence would not overcome that. Blind hatred for the moat and all its inhabitants welled up inside him. Damn it. We ought to be able to get her back from a bunch of goddamn animals, he blurted. Kutyasov looked up in surprise. His craggy eyebrows came closer together in a frown, then relaxed slightly.
Da, if that is all they are. But suppose they are more than that.
In any event, it's too late.
Yes, sir. They triggered the torpedoes.
2 hydrogen bombs. The field generator would vaporize in milliseconds, and MacArthur would... He writhed in pain at the thought. When the screens flared, she'd be gone. He looked up suddenly. "Where are my midshipmen, Admiral?"
Kutyasov grunted.
"They have decelerated to a lower orbit and are beyond the horizon. I will send a boat for them when everything is clear."
Strange, Rod thought. But they couldn't come directly to Lenin by the Admiral's orders, and the boats wouldn't provide any real protection when MacArthur exploded. What they had done was unnecessary caution, since the torpedoes did not give off a large fraction of their energy in X-rays and neutrons, but it was understandable caution. The timers twirled noiselessly to 0. Kutyasov watched grimly as another minute and another went past.
"The torpedoes did not fire," he said accusingly.
"No, sir." Rod's misery was complete. And now?
"Captain Mikhailov, you will please prepare main battery to fire on MacArthur."
Kutyasov turned his dark gaze to Rod.
"I dislike this, Captain. Not so much as you, but I dislike it.
Do you prefer to give order yourself? Captain Mikhailov, you permit?"
"Da, Admiral."
"Thank you, sir." Rod took a deep breath. A man ought to kill his own dog.
Shoot!
Space battles are lovely to see. The ships approach like smooth black eggs, their drives radiating dazzling light. Scintillations in the black flanks record the explosions of torpedoes that have escaped destruction from the stabbing colors of the secondary lasers. The main batteries pour energy into each other's fields, and lines of green and ruby reflect interplanetary dust. Gradually, the fields begin to glow. Dull red, brighter yellow, glaring green, as the fields become charged with energy. The colored eggs are linked by red and green threads from the batteries, and the colors change. Now 3 green threads linked Lennon and MacArthur. Nothing else happened. The battle cruiser did not move and made no attempt to fight back. Her field began to glow red, shading to yellow where the beams converged amidships. When it became white, it would overload, and the energy stored in it would be released, inward and out. Kutuzov watched in growing puzzlement.
"Captain Mikhailov, please take us back a click."
The lines on the admiral's brow deepened as Lenin's drive moved her gently away from MacArthur. MacArthur shaded green with faintly bluish spots. The image receded on the screens. Hot spots vanished as the lasers spread slightly. 1,000 kilometers away, she glowed richly in the telescopes.
"Captain, are we at rest with respect to MacArthur?"
Kutuzov asked.
"Da, Admiral."
"She appears to move closer."
"Da, Admiral. Her field is expanding."
"Expanding?"
Kutuzov turned to Rod.
"You have explanation?"
"No, sir." He wanted nothing more than oblivion. Speaking was pain, awareness agony. But he tried to think. "The Brownies must have rebuilt the generator, sir. And they always improve anything they work on."
"It seems pity to destroy it," Kutuzov muttered.
"Expanded like that, with that great radiating surface, MacArthur would be match for any vessel in fleet."
MacArthur's field was violet now, and huge. It filled the screens, and Kutuzov adjusted his to drop the magnification by a factor of 10. She was a great violet balloon, tethered by green threads. They waited, fascinated, as 10 minutes went by. 15.
"No ship has ever survived that long in violet," Kutuzov muttered.
"Are you still convinced we deal only with animals, Captain Blaine?"
"The scientists are convinced, sir. They convinced me," he added carefully. "I wish Dr. Horvath were here now."
Kutuzov grunted, as if struck in the belly.
"That fool! Pacifist! He would not understand what he saw."
They watched in silence for another minute. The intercom buzzed.
"Admiral, there is a signal from the Moat Embassy ship,"
the communications officer announced.
Kutuzov scowled. "Captain Blaine, you will take that call."
"I beg your pardon, sir."
"Answer the call from the Motis. I will not speak to any alien directly."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Its face was any Moti's face, but it sat uncomfortably erect, and Rod was not surprised when it announced, "I am Dr. Horvath's fiancé. I have distressing news for you, Captain Blaine. And by the way, we appreciate the warning you gave us. We don't understand why you wish to destroy your ship, but if we had been alongside..."
Blaine rubbed the bridge of his nose. "We're fighting a plague. Maybe killing MacArthur stopped it. We can hope.
Listen, we're a little busy now. What's your message?"
"Yes, of course. Captain, the 3 small craft which escaped from MacArthur have attempted re-entry to Moat Prime. I am sorry, but none survived."
Lenin's bridge seemed to fog.
"Re-entry with lifeboats? But that's plain silly. They wouldn't..."
"No, no, they tried to land. We tracked them part way. Captain, we have recordings of them. They burned up completely."
"God damn it to hell, they were safe!"
"We're terribly sorry."
Kutuzov's face was a mask. He mouthed,
"Recordings."
Rod nodded. He felt very tired. He told the Moti,
"We would like those recordings.
Are you certain that none of my young officers survived?"
"Quite certain, Captain. We are very distressed by this. Naturally, we had no idea they would attempt such a thing, and there was absolutely nothing we could do under the circumstances."
"Of course not. Thank you."
Rod turned off the screen and looked back at the battle display in front of him.
Kutuzov muttered, "So, there are no bodies and no wreckage.
Very convenient." He touched a button on the arm of his command couch and said,
"Captain Mikhailov, please send Cutter to look for the midshipmen."
He turned back to Rod.
"There will be nothing, of course."
"You don't believe the Motis, do you, sir?" Rod asked.
"Do you, Captain?"
I don't know, sir. I don't see what we can do about it."
"Nor I, Captain.
The Cutter will search and will find nothing. We do not know where they attempted re-entry. The planet is large. Even if they survive and are free, we could search for days and not find them. And if they are captives, they will never be found."
He grunted again, and spoke into his command circuit.
"Mikhailov, see that the cutter searches well, and use torpedoes to destroy that vessel, if you please."
"Yes, sir."
Lenin's captain spoke quietly at his post on the opposite side of the big bridge. A score of torpedoes arced out toward MacArthur. They couldn't go through the field. The stored energy there would fuse them instantly. But they exploded all at once. A perfect time-on-target salvo, and a great ripple of multicolored light swept around MacArthur's violet, glowing surface. Bright white spots appeared and vanished.
"Burned through in 9 places," the gunnery officer announced.
"Burned through into what?" Rod asked innocently. She was still his ship, and she was fighting valiantly for her life. The admiral snarled. The ship was 500 meters inward from that hellish violet surface. The bright flashes might never have reached her, or might have missed entirely.
"Guns will continue to fire. Launch another torpedo attack," Kutuzov ordered.
Another fleet of glowing darts arced out. They exploded all across the violet shimmering surface. More white spots rippled across, and there was an expanding ripple of violet flame. And then, MacArthur was as she was. A violet fire balloon, a full kilometer in diameter, tethered by threads of green light. A mess steward handed Rod a cup of coffee. Absently he sipped. It tasted terrible.
"Shoot!"
Kutuzov commanded. He glared at the screens in hatred.
"Shoot!"
And suddenly, it happened. MacArthur's field expanded enormously, turned blue, yellow, and vanished. Automatic scanners whirred, and the magnification of the screens increased. The ship was there. She glowed red, and parts had melted. She should not have been there at all. When a field collapses, everything inside it vaporizes.
"They must have fried in there," Rod said mechanically.
"Da! Shoot!"
The green lights stabbed out. MacArthur changed, bubbled, expanded, fuming air into space. A torpedo moved almost slowly to her, and exploded. Still the laser batteries fired. When Kutuzov finally ordered them off, there was nothing left but vapor. Rod and the admiral watched the empty screen for a long time. Finally, the admiral turned away.
"Call in the boats, Captain Mikhailov. We are going home."
33. Planet Fall. 3 smallish cones falling, a man nested in each, like an egg in an egg cup. Horst Staley was in the lead. He could see forward on a small square screen, but his rear view was all around him. Except for his pressure suit, he was naked to space. He turned gingerly to see 2 other flame-tipped cones behind him. Somewhere, far beyond the horizon, were MacArthur and Lenin. There was no chance that his suit radio would carry that far, but he turned to the hailing frequency and called anyway. There was no answer. It had all happened so fast. The cones had fired retro-rockets, and by the time he had called Lenin, it had been too late. Perhaps the signal crew had been busy with something else. Perhaps he had been slow. Horst felt suddenly alone. They continued to fall. The rockets cut off.
"Horst!"
It was Whitbread's voice. Staley answered.
"Horst, these things are going to re-enter!"
"Yeah, stick with it. What else can we do?"
That did not call for an answer. In lonely silence, 3 small cones fell toward the bright green planet below. Then, re-entry. It was not the first time for any of them. They knew the colors of the plasma field that builds before a ship's nose, colors differing according to the chemistry of the ablation shield. But this time, they were practically naked to it. Would there be radiation? Heat? Whipbread's voice reached Staley through the static.
"I'm trying to think like a brownie, and it isn't easy. They knew about our suits. They'd know how much radiation they'd stop. How much do they think we can take? And heat?"
"I've changed my mind," Staley heard Potter say.
I am not going down. Staley tried to ignore their laughter. He was in charge of three lives, and he took it seriously. He tried to relax his muscles as he waited for heat, turbulence, unfelt radiation, tumbling of the cone, discomfort, and death. Landscape streamed past him through plasma distortions, circular seas and arcs of river, vast stretches of city, mountains cased in ice and cityscape, the continuous city engulfing the slopes to the snowy peaks, a long stretch of ocean. Would the dam cones float? More land. The cones slowing, the features getting larger, air whipping around them now. Boats on a lake, tiny specks, hordes of them. A stretch of green forest, sharply bounded, laced by roads. The rim of Staley's cone opened, and a ring of parachute streamed back. Staley sagged deep into the contoured seat. For a minute, he saw only blue sky. Then came a bone-jarring thump. He cursed in his mind. The cone teetered and toppled on its side. Potter's voice rang in Staley's ears.
"I hae found the hover controls! Look for a sliding knob near the center. If the beasties hae done the same to all, that is the thrust control, and moving the whole bloody control panel on its support tilts the rocket."
Too bad he hadn't found it sooner, Staley thought. He said, "Get near the ground and hover there. The fuel may burn out. Did you find a parachute release, Potter?"
"No, 'tis hanging under me. Yon rocket flame must have burned it away by now. Where are you?"
"I'm down. Let me just get loose."
Staley opened the crash webbing and tumbled out on his back. The seat was 30 centimeters lower within the cone. He drew his weapon and burned out a hole to examine the space below. Compressible foam filled the compartment.
"When you get down, make sure there are no brownies aboard the lifeboat," he ordered crisply.
"Damn, I nearly flipped over," came Whitbread's voice. "These things are tricky." "I see you, Jonathan," Potter shouted. "Just hover, and I'll come to you."
"Then look for my parachute," Staley ordered.
"I don't see you. We could be 20 kilometers apart. Your signal is none too strong,"
Whitbread answered.
Staley struggled to his feet. "First things first," he muttered. He looked the lifeboat over carefully. There was no place a miniature might have hidden and lived through re-entry, but he looked again to be sure. Then he switched to hailing frequency and tried to call Lennon, expected no answer, and got none. Suit radios operate on line of sight only, and they are intentionally not very powerful. Otherwise, all of space would be filled with the chatter of suited men. The redesigned lifeboats had nothing resembling a radio. How did the brownies intend for survivors to call for help? Staley stood uncertainly, not yet adjusted to gravity. There were cultivated fields all around him, alternating rows of purple eggplant-looking bushes, with chest-high crowns of dark leaves, and low bushes bright with grain. The rows went on forever, in all directions.
"Still haven't spotted you yet, Horst," Whitbread reported. "This is getting us nowhere.
Horst, do you see a big, low building that gleams like a mirror? It's the only building in sight."
Staley spotted it. A metal gleaming thing beyond the horizon. It was a long walk away, but it was the only landmark in sight.
"Got it. We'll make for that, and meet you there."
"Good. Wait for me."
"Head that way, Gavin," Whitbread's voice said.
"Right,"
came the reply. There was more chatter between the other two, and Horst Staley felt very much alone.
"Whoop! My rocket's out!" Potter shouted.
Whitbread watched Potter's cone drop toward the ground. It hit point first, hesitated, and toppled into the plants. Whitbread shouted,
"Gavin, are you all right?"
There were rustling sounds. Then Whitbread heard,
"Oh, sometimes I get a twinge in my right elbow when the weather's nasty. Old football injury. Get as far as you can, Jonathan. I'll meet you both at the building."
"Aye, aye."
Whitbread tilted the cone forward on his rocket. The building was large ahead of him. It was large. At first, there had been nothing to give it scale. Now he had been flying toward it for 10 minutes or more. It was a dome, with straight sides blending into a low, rounded roof. There were no windows, and no other features except a rectangular break that might have been a door, ridiculously small in the enormous structure. The gleam of sunlight on the roof was more than metallic. It was mirror bright. Whitbread flew low, traveling quite slowly. There was something awesome about the building set in the endless croplands. That, more than the fear that his motor might burn out, checked his first impulse to rush to the structure. The rocket held. The miniatures might have changed the chemicals in the solid motor. No two things built by Motis were ever quite identical. Whitbread landed just outside the rectangular doorway. This close, the door loomed over him. It had been dwarfed by the building.
"I'm here,"
he almost whispered, then laughed at himself. "There's a doorway. It's big and closed. Funny, there aren't any roads leading here, and the crops grow right up to the edge of the dome." Staley's voice. "Perhaps planes land on the roof."
"I don't think so, Horst. The roof is rounded. I don't think there are ever many visitors.
Must be some kind of storage. Or maybe there's a machine inside that runs itself. Best not fool with it. Gavin, are you all right too?"
"Aye, Horst. I'll be at yon building in half an hour. See you there."
Staley prepared for a longer hike. There were no emergency rations that he could see in the lifeboat. He thought for a while before removing his combat armor and the pressure suit under it. There weren't any secrets there. He took the helmet and dogged it onto the neck seal, then rigged it as an air filter. Then he took the radio out of the suit and slung it on his belt, first making one last attempt to contact Lennon. There was no answer. What else? Radio, water bag, sidearm. It would have to do. Staley looked carefully around the horizon. There was only the one building. No chance of walking toward the wrong one. He started out toward it, glad of the low gravity, and swung easily into stride. A half hour later, he saw the first Moti. He was practically alongside before he noticed it, a creature different from any he'd seen before, and just the height of the plants. It was working between the rows, smoothing soil with its hands, pulling out weeds to lay between the careful furrows. It watched him approach. When he came alongside, it turned back to work. The Moti was not quite a brown. The fur patches were thicker, and more thick fur encased all three arms and the legs. The left hand was about the same as a brown's, but the right hands had five fingers each, plus a bud, and the fingers were square and short. The legs were thick, and the feet large and flat. The head was a brown's with drastically backsloping forehead. If Sally Fowler was right, that meant that the parietal area was almost nil. "Hello," Horst said anyway. The Moti looked back at him for a second, then pulled out a weed. Afterwards, he saw many of them. They watched him just long enough to be sure he wasn't destroying plants. Then they lost interest. Horst hiked on in the bright sunshine toward the mirror-bright building. It was much farther than he had thought. Mr. Midshipman Jonathan Whitbread waited. He had done enough of that since joining the Navy, but he was only 17 standard years old, and at that age, waiting is never really easy. He sat near the tip of the re-entry cone, high enough to bring his head above the plants. In the city, the buildings had blocked his view of this world. Here, he saw the entire horizon. The sky was brown all the way around, shading to something that might have had blue tinges directly overhead. Clouds roiled to the east in thick patches, and a few dirty white cumulus scudded overhead. The sun was just overhead, too. He decided he must be near the equator, and remembered that Castle City was far to the north. He could not sense the greater width of the sun's disk, because he could not look directly at it, but it was more comfortable to look at near than the small sun of New Scotland. The sense of an alien world was on him, but there was nothing to see. His eyes kept straying to the mirror-surfaced building. Presently, he got up to examine the door. It was a good 10 meters high, impressively tall to Whitbread, A gigantic thing for a Moti. But were Motis impressed by size? Whitbread thought not. The door must be functional. What was 10 meters high? Heavy machinery? There was no sound at all when he put his pickup microphone against the smooth, metallic surface. At one side of the alcove containing the door was a panel mounted on a stout spring. Behind the panel was what seemed to be a combination lock. And that was that. Except that Motis expected each other to solve such puzzles at a glance. A key lock would have been a no-trespassing sign. This was not. Probably it was intended to keep out, what, browns? Whites? Laborers and the non-sentient classes? Probably all of them. A combination lock could be thought of as a form of communication. Potter arrived panting, his helmet nearly awash with sweat, a water bag hanging from his belt. He turned his helmet mic to activate a small speaker and cut off his radio. "I had to try the Mote Prime Air for myself," he said. "Now I know. Well, what have you found?" Whitbread showed him. He also adjusted his own mic. No point in broadcasting everything they said.
I wish Dr. Buckman were here. Those are Moti numbers, aye. And the Mote solar system, with the dial where the Mote ought to be. Let me see."
Whitbread watched interestedly, as Potter stared at the dial. The new Scot pursed his lips, then said,
"Aye. The gas giant is 3.72 times as far from the Mote as Mote Prime.
He reached into his shirt pocket and took out the ever-present computer box.
3.88 base 12. Now which way does the dial go?"
"Then again, it might be somebody's birthday," said Whitbread. He was glad to see Gavin Potter. He was glad to see anyone human here. But the new Scot's meddling with the dials was disturbing. Left, right, left, right. Gavin Potter turned the dials.
"I seem to remember Horst gave us orders concerning this building."
Whitbread was uneasy.
"Best not fool with it. Hardly orders. We came to learn about Motis, did we not?"
"Well, it was an interesting puzzle."
"Try left again," Whitbread suggested.
"Hold it." Whitbread pushed the symbol representing Mote Prime. It depressed with a click.
"Keep going left." "Aye. The Moti astronomical maps show the planets going counterclockwise."
On the third digit, the door began to slide upward.
"It works!"
Whitbread shouted. The door slid up to a height of 1.5 meters. Potter looked at Whitbread and said,
"Now what?"
"You're kidding."
"We hae our orders,"
Potter said slowly. They sat down between the plants and looked at each other. Then they looked at the dome. There was light inside, and they could easily see under the door. There were buildings in there. Staley had been walking for 3 hours when he saw the plane. It was high up and moving fast, and he waved at it, not expecting to be seen. He was not, and he walked on. Presently he saw the plane again. It was behind him, much lower, and he thought it had spread wings. It settled lower and vanished behind the low, rolling hills where he had come down. Staley shrugged. It would find his parachute and lifeboat and see his tracks leading away. The direction should be obvious. There was nowhere else to go. In a few minutes, the plane was higher and coming straight toward him. It was moving slowly now, obviously searching. He waved again, although he had a momentary impulse to hide, which was plainly silly. He needed to be found, although what he would say to Emoti was not at all clear. The plane moved past him and hovered. Jet pipes curved down and forward, and it dropped dangerously fast to settle into the plants. There were 3 Motis inside, and a brown and white emerged quickly.
"Horst!"
it called in Whitbread's voice.
"Where are the others?"
Staley waved toward the rounded dome. It was still an hour's march away. Whitbread's Moti seemed to sag.
"That's Tornet. Horst, are they there yet?"
Sure, they're waiting for me. They've been there about 3 hours. Oh, my God. Maybe they couldn't get inside. Whitbread couldn't get inside. Come on, Horst. She gestured toward the plane. You'll have to squeeze in somehow. Another brown and white was inside, and the pilot was a brown. Whitbread's Moti sang something ranging through 5 octaves, and using at least 9 tones. The other brown and white gestured wildly. They made room for Staley between the contoured seats, and the brown did things to the controls. The plane rose and shot toward the building ahead.
Maybe they didn't get in, Whitbread's Moti repeated. Maybe.
Horst crouched uncomfortably in the speeding jet and wondered. He didn't like this at all. What's wrong? He asked.